My guest today has starred in not only one of film's greatest epic franchises, but also one of the greatest epic TV series in history. From The Lord of the Rings, one of AFI's top 50 films of all time, to the hit TV series Lost, one of Time Magazine's top 50 TV shows. Few, if any, have had such achievements on the big and small screen at such a young age. He's a Screen Actors Guild and Broadcast Film Critics Award winner with a global cult following, who's lived and worked in some of the most exotic places in the world and takes on many of the most bizarre, beautiful, and dangerous creatures in his BBC America series Wild Things with Dominic Monaghan. There are a few actors out there at any age who can claim to have had a more colorful and grand or adventurous career. I'm Maria Menounos, and this is my conversation with Dominic Monaghan.
You're listening to Conversations with Maria Menounos, a one-on-one, in-depth interview series with today's biggest stars and social influencers. And now, your host, Maria Menounos.
To give me what my due is, you know?
I was like, when you were halfway through it, I was like, okay, I'm going to try and ignore what she's saying because I don't want to, like, feel weird about this. But that was beautiful. Thank you.
Well, hey, you deserve it. You know, there are so many things I want to talk to you about, but I am so gushing over your new show, Wild Things, because, A, I'm a fan of nature. I'm a fan of animals. I'm even a fan of insects.
Best animal.
I mean, I wouldn't go that far, but I think it's such an amazing show, and I was really surprised when I first heard you were going off to do this, because we know you as an actor, and, you're yourself in this.
Right.
What was the kind of, why did you want to do this in the beginning? How did it all come together?
It's a passion of mine. I'm passionate about a lot of things, and I tend to, move forward in my life based on my passions, certainly in my work. You know, if you can work from a passionate point of view, then things feel like you're getting paid for doing no work, So I have been obsessed with animals all my life. I think one of my earliest memories is catching lizards when I was in Italy and Greece and Turkey when I was a kid.
I did it in Greece too.
Yeah, and they're not easy. I was saying this to a friend of mine earlier on today. They're not an easy animal to catch. Lizards are very fast. They bask in the sun. They get very, they're ectothermic, which means they use the sun for their energy, and then they move very fast once they're hot enough. So catching lizards when they're in the hot roasting sun of like Italy and Spain or Greece or Turkey is not to be underestimated. And when I was a kid, I could do it deftly. I don't even know if I could do it that well nowadays, And I remember having this distinct memory of going over to my dad. I tell this story all the time, and showing him this lizard that was in my hand. My dad's a biology teacher. My dad said, "That's great, but you can't keep it. It's not for you. It's not a pet. It's a wild animal. You have to let it go." And in my head, as a 6-7-year-old boy, I remember thinking, if I can't keep it, I want to examine it and see what it is and see if it's a male or a female or how big it is or does it want to bite me or is it tame or does it like me? And that started this curiosity thing, and I put the lizard down. And then over the course of the years, I've had, snakes, lizards, spiders, scorpions, praying mantis, centipedes. And anything that I see, anything in my life that I see, but certainly any animal that's alive that I see, I'm inquisitive as to how it exists, how it's solved the same issues that we've solved in our life. How do you stay alive? How do you find a partner? How do you find food? How do you find shelter? Those things are really fascinating to me. So it's something that's been in my life, and I've been interested in the work of Jacques Cousteau and David Attenborough and Steve Irwin. And then when Steve Irwin died, I was quite thrown by it for a few months, and I said to my ex-girlfriend at the time, I was like, this thing is like really affected me, and I need to try and spin this into a positive. And the positive is I'm going to try and work this now into this show that I've been talking about with all my friends and peers for years, which was this nature show. So I sat down with Animal Planet and Discovery Channel and different networks and different independent producers. And I said, look, this is how I holiday. Like, I pick an animal that I want to go see. I go to that country. I ask people about that animal. I see if I can find it in a week, in 2 weeks, in 10 days. And sometimes I'm lucky and sometimes I'm not. And a producer took a chance on me, and he said, I like that idea. And within like 8 weeks, I had come up with the idea for the pilot episode, which was army ants in Ecuador. And my vision for that particular episode was for me to lie down in a trail of army ants and see what it felt like to get taken over by them. But when I got there, I realized it was a little too graphic. So I ended up putting my hand into the midst of them and got stung by a bunch, and talked about how these tiny little animals are so effective and they basically rule the forest, you know? And then we carried on making the show. Oh, it's me and a cobra.
I saw that.
Yeah.
It was that clip that rushed me out of my office. I was watching everything I could to prepare for this interview, and I just was glued. I literally couldn't get enough videos online because I was so obsessed with it. And that was the video where I actually hit pause, walked out to the pit in the newsroom and was like, you guys got to see this. This guy is crazy. Like, you're on another level. I thought I was crazy. I'll catch snakes in the yard. I've eaten scorpions. I've eaten, you know, the craziest things. And, you know, I mean, I have no fear of animals because I always say, I think animals can read you, and they know my heart, and they know how much I love them. Mm-hmm. I've never been bitten by an animal, and, you know, I think unless you do something stupid that they get scared, I mean, for the most part, you should be okay. But that shot of that video clip of you chasing down this cobra, grabbing its tail and moving it around, and you've got that thing. I'm like, what is that thing going to do when that thing lunges at you?
Yeah,
and then all of a sudden, Dominic's in the cavity of the snake. Uh-huh. Like, what are you going to do then?
No, the snake stick will help. It's a hook. So essentially, you know, what I'm doing with the hook is constantly putting the snake's head on the other side of the hook.
To guide him.
Yeah, but anytime if the snake were to try and come towards me, there's a hook in the way, so it can't come back towards me. You see, it's a barrier. It's causing a barrier. But you're absolutely...
To me, it looks like it would go around his head here, and then he can lunge at you. No. And someone else was like, no, it's a noose. I'm like, so there must be a clip on the thing that the noose will tighten so that it won't get him, but...
No, it's not a noose. The idea behind it is essentially it's a barrier. You could have, like, a flat piece of wood at the end of that stick, and it would do the same thing. You're essentially just saying to the snake, you can stay on this side of the barrier, but if you come towards this way, there is a blockage, and the snake learns that. But you're absolutely right in terms of animals picking up on energy. Animals completely pick up on our energy. It's the reason why I'm able to hold venomous animals. There's a communication exchange between me and the animal. And at first, any wild animal that I see tries to escape and then tries to bite me, because that's what wild animals do. But within a couple of minutes or so of me actually physically holding on to them, there's a communication exchange where they realize, oh, this animal is actually not here to hurt me. It's here to just be with me for a little bit. And then I can get these animals that have these quite fearsome reputations to just sit and chill. Because what I want to show the audience is, you know, all animals deserve our respect and our time. And just because an animal's dangerous doesn't mean you should kill it, you know? I mean, they're important.
Very good point. Yeah. That is a really good point, actually, because, you know, it's funny. Like, I would know that even just holding it, you're sending energy through your arm that says, I'm not trying to capture you. I'm trying to, like you said, be with you.
Yeah. And, you know, I think a lot of human beings' feelings about dangerous animals are, if an animal is dangerous and has the capability to kill you, that means you are well within your rights to kill it. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel that way. I feel like if an animal is dangerous and can kill you, you need to be respectful of that power. But you can also spend time with that animal and understand that, you know, a little snake like this has the capability of ending my life. Like, that's a profound capability that I don't have, you know. So I want to show people that just because it's dangerous and potentially lethal, it's also interesting and important at the same time.
Well, and that's the thing that struck me the most when I was watching this is, you know, you're not just going out and playing with the lemur frog or, you know, something that's really kind of nebulous and, you know, isn't going to kill you. I mean, you're really kind of walking that fine line, if not, you know, there is no line because you're touching venomous creatures that could kill you. You know, what is it inside of you that will allow yourself in that position? Because, you know, I'm sure even movies have a hard time kind of ensuring you knowing that this is what you're going out and doing, right?
Yeah. I mean, the insurance company on this called my agent and, you know, had a long conversation with my agent that was then transferred over to me when we started doing season one. And he was like, look, this insurance company is really worried. They don't want to insure you because we've told them what you're going to do and they're nervous. And I just said to my agent, I'm going to do it anyway. The show's greenlit. Someone has to insure me. So either we give them the money or we give it to another company. So someone eventually has to do it. So they did do it. The reason why I work with dangerous animals, and I do work with other animals, it's the lemur leaf frog episode tonight, which is not a dangerous animal. I mean, it's mildly poisonous, but I mean, you know, you're not going to die from it. The reason why I work with dangerous animals is because we know the stories about are dogs and cats and horses and rabbits and guinea pigs, and they're amazing animals too. And we also know the stories about these charismatic animals nowadays, the lions, the tigers, the gorillas, the polar bears. Those stories are never going to go away. It's the stories of the underdog. It's the stories of the vilified. It's the stories of the disgusted animals that I want to tell, because people shun them. You know, we like touched upon insects just then. Like, insects are the most successful species of animal on the planet. They live everywhere. They dominate the planet. No other animal could exist on the planet if insects weren't the dominating species that owned the planet. But it's also probably the most vilified and shunned type of animal. Mm-hmm. Someone sees even a bee. I mean, bees are so incredible. They make honey, for goodness sake. And people are like, ooh, a bee, and they'll just crush it. And it's not being aggressive. It's not trying to hurt you. Some people grow up with these ideas that insects are dirty, or they're aggressive, or they'll hurt you, or they're brainless. And they're not. And I want to show that on this show.
I think that's cool. I've always said I'm not God, so I don't have the right to take their life.
For sure.
So when I find there's a certain spider that just lives in my bathroom right now, and I look at him every day when I go to the bathroom, he's right there on the wall, and I'm like, there's like a little hole. Some of the drywall has like fallen apart there because of some water damage. And I just look at him, I'm like, all right, that's your home. Yeah. And I'm constantly, if there's a cricket in the house or anything, I'm catching it with a tissue and bringing it outside. And people think I'm nuts, but I do believe that.
Yeah.
I don't think that's crazy.
No, and I think it's crazy to think that that is nuts. I get called crazy a lot. I get, you know, people say, is there something wrong with you? Are you mental because you do this show? But for me, it's the, like people ask me if I have a death wish. For me, it's the complete opposite.
Yeah.
It's about life. This whole show is about life. It's not about death. It's about the earth and the animals that we share space with, and the life that they have. Like, I have absolutely no inclination whatsoever to die or get killed by these animals, because I want to show people that you can spend time with them. But, you know, I'm willing to remind people that you can get close to these animals with respect and treat them correctly, and they tend to not act out with you.
Yeah, I think it's obviously your passion, but it's also nice that it's paired with a purpose to kind of educate people. I think with the insects, what's interesting is that people feel like they're plentiful.
Right.
So you can crush an ant, and you can crush any kind of insect, because they're more plentiful. And then that kind of carries over to the elephants and like the larger animals. It just keeps on going. The lemurs obviously have a problem. We were talking about that in Madagascar.
Sure.
They're facing extinction. So many animals are. So I guess if you're able to kind of prove this point with some of the most feared animals, maybe it would carry over.
Potentially change people's ideas. I mean, there's a total miseducation about, you know, animals and certainly extinction and stuff. More insects go extinct on a daily basis than any other type of animal on
the
planet.
No way, I didn't know that.
For sure.
Where did you learn all of this? Because as you were doing this and as I was watching you, you're also so incredibly knowledgeable, and you know it's not someone feeding you all of this information. You obviously have been doing this, and I know you said earlier that that's how you took your vacations. Your vacations were this, but you know, how have you really acquired all this knowledge? Is it just a lot of reading and experiencing?
It is a lot of reading. I do read a lot of field guides. You know, I have field guides on almost any type of animal in every part of the world. I mean, you know, field guides to reptiles on every continent, insects, mammals, fish, birds. So I will spend a lot of time reading about that. A lot of it is the animal will actually tell you a lot if you just observe it. You know, there's a scene that we do we're in Brazil, and we see these monkeys, which are called night monkeys. And I didn't know a huge amount about night monkeys, and we kind of happened upon these animals. But what I understood very quickly from watching these night monkeys is, because of the way that they look and the way that they behave, you can make a couple of pretty good assumptions about these animals. They have massive eyes. Usually animals with massive eyes, forward-facing eyes, are nocturnal, because they use those big eyes to look at night. They're also kind of a hardy animal, because they live in trees and they fall down a lot. So it's kind of a tough little monkey. So as I'm talking about these animals and observing them, I'm also realizing these new pieces of information that's coming to me based on a small amount of education that I've had about these animals, you know? I mean, I'm not a biologist. I'm an enthusiastic animal lover. And I say that to people all the time when they interview me. You know, they say, what's your level of education? I just say, look, I'm just super enthusiastic about it. I do a lot of my own kind of groundwork at home. But The animal will tell you everything that you need to know if you just watch it.
Mm-hmm. That's funny. I always felt like the greatest part of my job as a reporter was to be able to go do these kinds of things. You know, when I worked for Nightly News, I went to Africa and did a series on the orphaned elephants. Mm. And, you know, getting to be in that world and experiencing it all is amazing. And I was the girl in junior high and high school that never had pictures of boys on the walls. I had pictures of animals. And so I love them. I thought of something in particular. One of the episodes, you were in a marketplace, and seeing those marketplaces in these other countries is so different, obviously, than what we see here in the mm-hmm. States. You know, you're seeing the hoofs hanging from the ceilings, right. And that's kind of creepy. But I loved when you went into, it was a Vietnamese restaurant, and there were balls on the menu, penis. Mm-hmm. I wrote like a sticky note. I couldn't believe it. It was steamed penis, balls,
yeah,
and scorpions. And I was like, I've done scorpions with some spicy salsa. It's pretty good. Okay. I mean, it's just crispy something or other.
Yeah.
I've actually had balls, too.
Nice. I could see that. I could definitely see that.
Not willingly, though. Well, that sounds so bad. My uncle was a hunter, and I went to his house one day, and he had a plate, and it looked like steak tips or something. I was so hungry, so I grabbed them, I ate them, I was chewing, and I'm like, God, these are chewy. And then the next Sunday in church, I look over, and he was a jokester, and he looks a little bit like Jack Nicholson, and he's hysterically crying laughing in church. And I look at him, I'm like, why are you laughing at me? And later he told me that I ate goat balls.
Nice.
So
wait, they call them sweetbreads, right? That's what we call them in England.
I don't know.
Testicles are called sweetbreads. I don't really know why, because they're not sweet and they're not bread. But that's
they were chewy. Did you eat the balls that day?
No.
No.
I saw them, and they were substantial. And to be fair, so was the penis. I don't know if it was like a royal goat or something, but it was definitely something that would give you you wouldn't have an appetite at the end of it. But no, I wasn't a huge fan of eating it. We started doing the show, and they wanted me to eat quite a lot of bizarre food, bizarre insects and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I said to the guys in episode one, I was like, look, I love insects and I love animals. This is not a show about me going around the world eating bizarre insects.
Andrew Zimmerman's doing that.
Andrew Zimmerman's got that covered, and he does it really well. And also, like, I love those animals. I don't want to eat them. You know, they offered me scorpion that day, and I was mm-hmm. like, look, I spend so much time with these animals.
I remember.
They're crawling across me when I'm camping at night. I don't want to eat one of their kind, and then I'll get stung by them. I truly believe in the whole cyclical karma thing. So if I eat a scorpion, maybe, you know, the ante comes along a couple of years later and stings me, and I don't want to do that.
It's true.
But
are you a vegetarian?
No. Pescatarian.
Got it. I always say I'm an aspiring vegetarian. I just try to make as few choices in that category as I can.
Yeah, I don't eat a huge amount of meat, but I do find that if I don't eat meat, and it's usually fish, my energy just wanes. Mm. So over the course of like a month or so, my energy will just wane to the point where I'm like, I need some flesh.
Yeah.
But we were talking before the show, which is, you know, was a really fantastic conversation about the fact that, you know, you do love this world so much mm-hmm. and you like doing it. And this year I was lucky enough to have someone come along with me to New Zealand. I took Billy Boyd, who I did Lord of the Rings with. It was a great fit, you know, because he was a hobbit, I was a hobbit. We went back to New Zealand and, you know, saw some of the movie sets that we worked on. What I had said to my producing team for season three was, I was like, we need a girl, and we need kind of a girly looking girl because that girly girl is going to break through all these ideas that girls think insects are icky or they think snakes are disgusting and stuff. So at some point, when we put together season three, we're probably going to be pitching you an idea of, like,
I'm down.
Come to Honduras or come to Guatemala or come to Kenya. And,
and
you can do it.
It.
And I'll show you how to do some of this stuff with snakes. I mean, you know, There's a rule system that we all work off with my crew. I mean, the first year with my crew, as soon as we found a snake, my entire crew just bounced backwards, and they'd have the boom on the longest boom, and the camera guy would be in a long lens, and I was like, no, you guys can come closer, you guys can come closer. And I talk about this circumference of safety. So depending on what type of snake it is, there's a circumference of safety. Vipers have a very small one.
Mm-hmm.
Pythons have a relatively big one. And things like cobras and elapids have a relatively big one too. But there's rules that you need to follow. And if you follow those rules, you won't get bitten.
That's so amazing. I'm down. Like I said, I thought that I was brave before I started watching your show. And then I was like, oh, this is a whole other level. I need to graduate. So.
Why? What's different? What wouldn't you do at this point?
I think, I mean, I love snakes. I have no problem with snakes. I don't think I could easily chase a random snake in the wild, like a cobra like that. I think I would be very, very afraid. I think with you feeding off of your energy, I wouldn't be as afraid. Mm. And, you know.
Spiders? You're okay with spiders?
Yeah. Scorpions. I mean, I don't know how I'm going to feel really kind of handling them, but I trust. And so, you know, the reason why I've eaten scorpions and some of those interesting things is I didn't want to do that. I was doing a segment with Andrew Zimmerman, in fact, and I was like, I'm not going to eat that stuff. I'm not a fear factor person. And when I sat with him, he educated me on the fact that this is protein in certain countries and this is what they eat. This is just how their culture is. And I'm like, well, someone came here and I was trying to get them to eat an In-N-Out burger. I'd be like, trust me,
yeah,
this
yeah,
is what we eat.
Yeah, yeah.
So I ate them for that reason. But I definitely would be scared handling a scorpion, but I also love to face my fears.
Right.
So
that's
I would be important. So fascinated. I love adventure. I love trying new things. I would have a blast.
Very empowering to face your fear. And I think out of all those things, the easiest to handle is a scorpion.
Really?
Yeah. Scorpions are very timid. They're not that keen on stinging. They telegraph very easily when they're getting annoyed. Their tail
goes up.
Yeah. Their tail will come up. Their pincers will start to come up. And they'll give you a few seconds of warning. They won't just strike out of nowhere, you know. So they'll kind of say, hey, I'm getting annoyed. And you put them down and then they chill. Spiders are a little harder to read. They don't really give you that much kind of telegraphing. And then certain snakes are just gnarly. I mean, like pythons are fine. Pythons will cruise and they'll tell you when they're annoyed. But things like mambas and cobras, they're cheeky, you know. They'll be like, no, I'm fine. And then they'll just bite you, you know.
God, so what are your injuries to date from this show?
I'll take my jacket off and show you. I have a pretty significant scar from this year on my forearm.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So that's teeth.
That looks like an M. Like
right?
Someone, like you carved an M in here.
Yeah. And then tooth, and a little tooth there. This is from a large 8.5-foot... lizard that bit me in Thailand.
An 8.5-foot lizard?
Yeah.
I've never heard of one that big.
Monitor lizard. You know what a monitor lizard
No.
is?
No.
It's like a slightly more weightier Komodo dragon. Komodo dragons are longer and a little bit more crocodilian shape. Monitor lizards have like big fat bellies and stuff. And we just found this. We found this monster in
just
the forest.
Randomly.
Yeah. And
what were you looking for when you bumped into this lizard?
We went to Thailand looking for the slow loris, which is the world's only venomous primate.
Okay.
And it's a nocturnal animal. So in the daytime, we were looking for other animals and just, you know, looking around. And this is a big lizard. So it was making a lot of noise in the forest. And we started rolling and worked with this animal. And anytime you get bitten by an animal, it's always your fault. And I've heard Steve Irwin say that a bunch of times. And I
believe
heard,
that, though, because
totally
you're doing
is,
something to frighten them.
It totally is. You've not listened to that message, that very clear message, you know. And this lizard told me a couple of times to leave it alone. It had had enough. It was hot. It didn't want to mess with me. It didn't want me messing with it anymore. And I looked to my director and I said, are we done? Can we finish the scene? And he was like, I don't think we're done because the lizard is so tired out that he looks like he's just chilling. He looks like he's not wild. He looks like a big puppy dog, you know. He was just sat there taking big, deep breaths in the hot sun. And I said, well, I can wake him up a little bit and we can get him to maybe escape and run away and that can be the scene. And he said, okay, try that. And,
the
lizard was not into it and it turned around and bit me. But the interesting thing about that is for the lizard, that's just another day. It's not a big deal. Could have bitten me on the foot and run away. Could have bitten me on the arm and run away. Could have bitten my hand off and run away.
Yeah.
3 minutes later, that lizard was sat in a different part of the forest, not even thinking about it. Just
totally.
Like, cool, all right, I'll get some more sun or I'll go find a lady to hang out with. They don't have that stress factor that humans do. Like if a human gets into a fight, you know, that you can be in therapy for years after a scuffle. Lizards, those type of animals, they do it every day. It's just part of who they are. So, and it's also part of the show. These are wild animals, you know, so we kind of want to show that potential can always happen. I would never get myself in that situation with a highly venomous animal. I wouldn't do that with a cobra. I wouldn't do that with a viper because you're talking about a lifelong set of issues. They can deal, you know, they can harm your internal organs for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't play with that. But with a monitor lizard, a big bite's going to be sore, painful.
You like on your phone Googling how bad this situation could be before you weigh out how far you go with it?
Well, we you know, I, like with most reptile stuff, I'm pretty good with. We have a herpetologist that comes with us, and we're always weighing up the dangers. So when we find an animal, if we're in a situation where we can all take a breath before we do the scene, between myself and the herpetologist, we'll do a little speech with the crew, and we'll go, okay, that's a puff adder. So that means you can stand here, but you can't stand here. Mm-hmm. And if I say this, you have to do X, Y, and Z. So we'll have that little conversation, and then we'll start.
When it bit you, did you cry? Because that's major.
No, I haven't cried for years. I'm cold and dead inside.
You are?
Yeah. Well, no, that's not true. I cried on the plane watching Frozen.
You did?
to the extent where some lady asked if I was okay. It was very sweet. I was on a plane coming back from New York. I was watching Frozen. And I had my screen slightly turned away from her. And I was, you know, crying a little bit. Not weeping, but I was like, oh, that's emotional. And the lady who I'd been chatting to a little bit before we took off nudged me and said, are you okay?
Aww.
And I took off my headphones and I turned the screen around. And I went, I'm watching Frozen. She was like, oh, you're okay.
So
such a great film, right? I love Frozen.
It. I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, it's so sweet. There's a song in it. It's called Do You Want to Build a Snowman? Oh, it's so cute.
Okay, now I have to watch that.
It's great.
So you've got this one.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any other kind of
nothing
on par? Anything that got you in the hospital and sick for a while?
No, nothing significant.
Thank goodness.
I mean, I've been stung by scorpions. I've been bitten by quite a few non-venomous snakes. I've been bitten by a few kind of wild-ish dogs. Nothing too gnarly. At the end of season one of Wild Things, at the end of each block, we tend to do two episodes at the same time, I'll come back and see my doctor. And at the very end of season one, I went to see my doctor and we ran a whole series of tests. And I was like, how is everything? He said, everything's fine. But he said, you're like full of parasites, so we need to take care of them. I was like, really?
You're joking.
Yeah.
You're joking.
No, he was like, all your like upper and lower intestine is just full of parasites. So I was like, what does that mean? He was like, it means you have to like change your diet.
It's from the food you were eating in those random places.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
Your body's not used to that. That's what it is.
And they start to breed in them.
Yeah.
And multiply and stuff. So
yeah, because if you stayed there, you would get used to that.
Right, right. Because they're all eating those salad leaves and they're drinking that water. But for someone like me, the parasite is like, ooh, we got something new blood, you know. It's why mosquitoes go for me. They don't go for the locals. Mosquitoes love me, but the locals are just like, ah, it doesn't bother me.
That's so funny.
So we get murdered by mosquitoes. We get murdered by sand flies and black flies. But no, the only real significant thing was this. And
to be fair,
like, this for me adds a nice level of authenticity to the show because it shows people that it happens and it's real. This is not on a movie set, you know.
Yeah.
These animals are wild, you know. So, I mean, you know, they talk about those moments being like near-death experiences. I always flip them on their head and call them acute life experiences because for me, I feel the most alive I've ever been when I'm that close to death or close to, you know, an injury happen. We got chased by an elephant this year in episode one and it almost killed my cameraman and it was complete bedlam, you know, like crew running all over the place, cars driving everywhere.
And they're deceivingly fast, too.
Very, very fast.
Yeah.
But as that was happening and as I was processing it all, I was just like, this is one of the most fantastic moments in my life. I felt so alive. I felt so connected to everything.
Yeah.
You know? It's a cool feeling.
I wonder, what have your friends and castmates from your shows and movies said about this?
Yeah, they do a lot of, you're crazy, you're mental. I mean, like my real friends, my mom and dad and my brother.
They
and
know you, they know this is you.
Yeah, my closest friends know it's me and they think that it's a very authentic representation of me. They're like, oh, this is actually you on TV.
Mm-hmm.
It's not Charlie from Lost or it's not this guy from Flash Forward or whatever. It's you, which is true. But people who kind of know me just kind of say, you know, wouldn't it be easier to do like, you know, world's greatest beaches or, you know, top 50 fantastic hotels in the world. Like, I could do a show.
But you're like
that.
Why? That's not what I want to do.
Yeah, it's not. And I'll do that when I'm 60. You know, when my hips aren't working and my knees aren't working anymore, I'll go do the greatest restaurants in the world. But at this point, I'm into a different message, you know.
That's so crazy. So what about your castmates? Have they all said the same thing? You're crazy? Because they know you. They've spent so much time with you at that point. You know, I feel like they'd have a good handle on you.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them knew. Certainly in Hawaii, I was known as being the person that if I was on set, people would say, hey, let's see if we can wrangle Dom out of his trailer because we have a centipede on set, we want to move, or we have a scorpion on set, we want to move. Because what had happened once was that someone grabbed a Leatherman, you know, the little multi-tools, and just picked up this centipede and obviously killed it and threw it somewhere. And I was like, guys, don't do that. If you're going to do that, like, tell me and I'll move it. And you won't get bitten and the centipede will stay alive. So my castmates definitely knew that I was into animals. I kept chameleons in Hawaii and, you know, I had a whole menagerie in my garden of chameleons. I think if you're passionate about something to that extent, it's a part of you. You know, mm-hmm. it's a huge part of you. And like we're having this conversation, I get very animated when I talk about these type of things because it's what I'm into, you know. But I think because it's something that they wouldn't do, they kind of look at it with a slightly bizarre mm-hmm. distance. They're like, wow, I would never do that. How are you able to do that? But for me, it just feels normal. It's the way that I holiday, like I said. So
yeah.
I'll do this for the rest of my life, whether I'm doing it on a TV show or just doing it, because I want my kids, when I eventually have them, to have the same experiences, to learn about animals in the same way.
I love it. I absolutely love it. And I understand the bizarre looks, because I've gotten them when I started wrestling. People are like, what are you going to do? And I'm like, I love wrestling. I have a chance to go wrestle in the WWE. I'm going to do it. And I did it. It was the greatest high of my life. So amazing. And then I was like, I'm going to do it again. They want me to wrestle at WrestleMania now. And are you a wrestling fan by any chance?
I know wrestling.
Okay.
I do know. Who did you wrestle? Did you get injured?
Well, teeny minor things, but when I wrestled at WrestleMania, I was doing Dancing with the Stars at the same time. I had 2 broken ribs, 7 fractures in my feet, and I went to wrestle in WrestleMania. And
that is a little crazy.
It's a little crazy, pretty ballsy. But I luckily came out the other end, and it was the most amazing experience of my life ever. But I know that my friends, I had one friend in particular. She's a little more, one of my fancier friends. She's like, Maria, you can't do this. She's like, people are going to start thinking you're a wrestler, and that's not what you want. And I said to her, I think people are going to know this girl follows her passion. Mm-hmm. And whatever that is going to be okay because it's her passion. So I've always said to people, if you genuinely are passionate about something, no one can hurt you. Mm-hmm. No one can say anything that's going to penetrate. They can tell you you're crazy all day long. It's never even going to connect.
Yeah, you're insulated in that sense. But yeah. I totally agree with that. I mean, it's, you know, it's an interesting concept, chasing your passion, because, you know, a lot of people don't get that opportunity. Some people mm-hmm. have to work in different fields that isn't necessarily their passion. So if you're lucky enough to do it, I think you always have to stay positive and you know, remind people that you are super lucky. You know, I'm passionate about other things too. I mean, you know, I love football. I love soccer. I'm a huge Manchester United fan. I'm from Manchester. You know, we always try and put football into the show. I put kids into the show because I love young people. I think young people have the ability to really change the way that we feel about animals. So we always have young people in the show. We have street food in the show because I don't tend to eat in restaurants when I travel around the world. I eat on the street, and that's the best, freshest food that you can get, you know? So, if the show, in a sense, can shake people's ideas about how they might think they should holiday. You know, I mean, a lot of people, I think it's something like 51% of people from the United States don't have a passport. So you have a lot of people flying to great places like Vegas and San Diego and New York and Chicago. Those are all great cities. But my whole thing is like, that's great. But if you went to a place that had a different currency and a different language and a different food, it would take your brain out, shake it, and then put it back mm-hmm. in again. And if you change your mind, you make it grow. And that's a really important thing.
Absolutely. I think the key thing with you is that no one gave this to you either, though, because you had to go out and do it. And I'm sure, like, you get the bizarre looks now, you were getting the bizarre looks then, because people know you as one thing and everyone always wants to kind of keep you in that box because that's where they feel most comfortable.
Yeah, yeah. You're always going to get put in the box, especially as an actor. And I sat down with my agent.
He definitely didn't get it.
No, he did not.
Well, and he didn't want to get it, I bet.
I'll tell you a funny story about my agent's reaction to that. But I sat down with my agent like 15 years ago and we you know, hatched this plan, this 3, 5, 7, 10, 15-year plan of what I wanted to do. And I said, I do not want to be pigeonholed. The actors that I admire are Tim Roth, Anthony Hopkins, Gary Oldman, Liam Neeson, Daniel Day-Lewis. Actors that have made a direct choice to not be pigeonholed. You think I'm this, now I'm something else. You think I'm this, now I'm something else. Mm-hmm. So we went on that path as an actor, but I also said to my agent, the other thing that I need to do is show people that I'm a little bit more than just that thing, because we all are.
Yeah.
You're much more than this show. You know, you have all these other passions. So if I can also do that, it would be important. But when I did the nature show and we greenlit the nature show and we were going to do 8 episodes and all that kind of stuff, my agent called me up and I was just about to go to Ecuador and he was like, okay, so you're going to go do your little thing and then And then when you come back, we'll get you a real job. And I was like, Ryan, this is a real job. And when you see the show, you'll know that it's a real job. And then we showed him the show and, you know, he kind of got his mind blown. He was like, he's the same. He's like, I don't understand how you're doing it. And I also don't understand that you can do this and other people don't have the ability to do that. Like, it's like an annuity. You create a little annuity for yourself. Mm-hmm. You know? That's what it's all about.
But I feel like, you know, if it wasn't your passion, you wouldn't be able to execute and people wouldn't buy it. But I wonder when you sat down with him and kind of hatched this plan with him, did he caution you against it because of what the film community may think? Because a lot of your business is based on people not knowing you as a person so that you can play these different characters. Mm. Was that a concern at any point?
No, because I think he saw that the overriding passion with the animals and the character, if you will, that's being created in this animal show was so strong and so powerful that it would override any of that stuff. I mean, I'm going to jump from here to go do a Swedish cop show next, which is, you know, it's funded out of Sweden. It's going to show in Sweden. It's not going to show in the States
yet.
No
way.
Yeah, I'm sure someone will pick it up. But at the moment, it's just a Swedish cop show because I love, you know, Swedish cop shows are very sexy right now with The Bridge and the, what's the other one? The Fall? No, not The Fall. I'm missing one. The Killing. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
The Bridge and The Killing. So it's the same group of people that made The Bridge and The Killing. And they're doing another Scandinavian show. So again, that was like, okay, now I'm nature boy. So now I'm going to go back and do actory stuff, you know. But I always knew that my path in the acting career was not going to be the same as anyone else's. You know, I was lucky enough to, and still am friends with people like Orlando and, you know, knew Heath Ledger when he was around and have met Colin Farrell a few times. And I was like, I'm not those guys. Like, yeah. I'm not 6'2". I'm not a model. I don't, you know, I'm not going to be the guy that has the same career trajectory where you smash and you pop in the way that they are. So how do I navigate my way through this career where I'm still satisfied with what I'm going to do? And the interesting thing that I'm able to do is jump into different roles. I think it's much harder for someone like Orly, yeah, who has to be the stud and he has to be the guy that gets the girl and he has to be cleanly shaven. But I don't. I can rough myself up. I can be an old guy. I can be a drug addict. I can be a rock star. So I realized that maybe I wasn't going to get the same amount of, you know, Steve McQueen, Paul Newman kind of gravitas, but I was also going to do the more interesting roles like Gary Oldman in his early career, mm-hmm, or like Tim Roth in his early career.
Well, also in what's authentic to you, which I think a lot of people get lost in this business, excuse me, because there's this idea of who they want to be and they're chasing that and they're not really being authentic to who they are. Right. And I always tell people, you know, we have 200 hosts at AfterBuzz, our digital platform. I'm like, everyone's different. You all bring something different to the table. Know what that is and be good to that, because that's what's going to feed you at the end of the day. Stop trying to be me or her, because you're not. We're all different.
Yeah, yeah. Work to your strengths, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm kind of a goofball on the red carpet. I'm constantly, like, you know, widening my eyes and smiling at myself, messing around with my bow tie or, you know, painting my nails, which I do all the time. And, you know, my agent in my early career, my agent has kind of said to me, you know, in that situation, like at the SAG Awards or at the Golden Globes, you want to wear like a black suit and a black tie and a white shirt and don't paint your nails and do your hair to the side. And I'm like, but that's not me, you know, it's not an expression of me. I want it to be me. And surely the reason why I'm at the SAG Awards is because people seem to appreciate something that I've done, you know. So that constantly happens. I mean, I honestly, now the reason why I probably paint my nails more than any other reason is to empower other guys who may want to paint their nails but feel like it's a female thing or it's a sissy thing or it's a weird thing to have complete fashion and clothing rights. I mean, there was a point where women weren't allowed to wear trousers and women just went, you know what, that's not cool, we're going to wear trousers. And maybe for a couple of months everyone was like, we're not into that, but then they got used to it. And I think it's the same with guys. Like, if you want to wear nail polish because it matches your shoes or your shirt, do it. It's not saying anything about your sexuality. And if it does say something about your sexuality, that doesn't matter either.
Yeah.
You know, like, I never have come out about being straight or gay in the media because I don't think it's relevant or it matters to what I'm doing as a career. Even if I were to play a gay guy or a bisexual guy or a transsexual and someone were to ask me about my sexuality, I'd be like, how is that relevant to what I'm doing? Like, you can ask me about the character's sexuality, But yeah. it doesn't matter. Sexuality doesn't matter, you know?
Well, I think that's interesting because I heard recently that Kevin Spacey was grilled about his sexuality. And I think it's such a touchy subject. Like, why do people care so much? And by the way, I work in a business that's super curious. And right. that's, you know, the basis of our shows is like getting to the bottom of everything. Everyone wants to know all of these things. But there are certain things where I'm just like, why? Right. Like, why is that so fascinating to you? Right. Why is that so interesting? Why do we need to know what actors are gay or not? Right. Aren't we supposed to just appreciate their performance, love them for what they did or not?
Right. And it's called private life for a reason, you know? I mean, I love what I do. I love being an actor. I take everything that comes along with it. The fact that there's certain places that I don't go at certain times and there's certain events that occur that are a little difficult for me to navigate through. I'm fine with that because I love being an actor, but it's called private life because it's private. You have mm-hmm. to keep some things private. I don't talk about my parents. I don't really talk about my brother. I don't talk about, you know, whoever I happen to be dating at the time, because you have to keep something sacred. Mm-hmm. Everything else is fodder. Everything else. Everyone knows mm-hmm. what my favorite food is, what clothes I like to wear, what my favorite city is, you know, what my favorite animal is. There has to be something that you keep for yourself. Yeah. Otherwise, you're like a shell by the end of it. You know, you got nothing. You've given it all away. You have
this
to keep
true.
All of it.
Although you've been pretty outspoken on social media.
Yeah, I mean, I have a voice. You know, that's the other thing. Like, I mean, social media is about having a voice, yeah. you know, and I have one. And if someone asks me a question, I'll tend to come back with something honest. And if I'm feeling a little spiky that day, or if I'm feeling like I want to get that point across, what I tend to do on social media is, because you're on Twitter, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you'll get the odd just idiot who's just nasty for no apparent reason.
Oh, yeah.
So what I tend to do is I ask the person the question, you know, why are you nasty? What did I do?
Wait, I did the same thing.
Really?
So, why would you be mean to me? I don't know what I've done.
I try to wake them up to a semi-shaming moment where mm-hmm. I'm like, hey, I don't know you. You don't know me. Why are you coming at me with this thing? And I let them hang themselves with their own rope, because usually if you engage with them, they'll come back with something way more hateful.
Really? Yeah. See, I found the complete opposite.
Oh, you get them going.
I think that they... A lot of people don't realize what they're kind of, the hate they're spewing out there. And then when you call them on it, they're like, oh, shoot, I was just having a bad day. I'm so sorry. Like, right. this has nothing to do with you.
Right.
But you found the complete opposite.
Yeah, I mean, I have found that too. But more often than not, I'll find them, you know, go at me because now they've got me and they've got a voice, you know. And you know, a lot of times what you want to say to them is like, this isn't ran by a fan site. This is me. And also, I'm a human too. Like, you know, anyone has the ability to say something to me and I can read it and it can affect me, you know. So what I'll do is I'll, you know, ask them why they would say that. Lots of times they'll come back with something a little bit more vermin, and then I'll just retweet it. And then the large group of people that follow me on Twitter will mm-hmm. then go after that person and be like, why would you say that stuff? And then it gives them a taste of their own medicine. They're like, whoa, people are coming at me with a lot of negativity and it feels bad. And then a couple of hours later, I'll be like, see,
mm-hmm.
that's what it feels like, you know?
So funny. This is so fun. I love that I haven't even looked at any of my questions because I'm just having so much fun with you. You know, you were chased by an elephant, or you and your crew was.
Mm.
Where was that exactly?
Yeah, it was in Kenya.
It was in Kenya. Because I've been there for a series on the orphaned elephants in Nairobi. Went to Sheldrick's.
Nice.
Did you go to Sheldrick's?
No, we were in a place called Tsavo National Park.
The woman who runs Sheldrick's, her husband, David, I think his name was David Tsavo.
Mm-hmm.
He was the one who ran that whole wildlife park.
Yeah, it's very, very impressive.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, very sad at the same time. I mean, it's a very complex situation going on over there. You've got locals, let's say, people who live in that part of Kenya, who know for a fact that if they're able to get ivory from an animal that happens to just live in their backyard in the mm-hmm. same way that a coyote or a raccoon might, that they can then pay for all their kids' education, all their kids' food, and not have to have sleepless nights worrying about that thing. And it's a tough thing for them to try and justify, I'm not going to kill this animal, and my children might suffer because of that. But what this vet did that we worked with was go and help animals that had been shot with arrows. A lot of these people don't have guns. They have bow and arrows. So the arrows will actually kill the elephant over the course of like 6 weeks or so. So they'll put like 30 or 40 arrows into this elephant on a nightly basis. So they'll, that's terrible. So they'll see the same elephant. They'll be like, that's the guy that I shot yesterday. Put an arrow in it. The elephant will react. And then they'll go home for the night. And then the next night they'll find the same elephant. And they'll do that over the course of a month or so. And the elephant will succumb to the infection from the arrow. So we worked with this elephant that had an arrow in its leg, tranquilized it, took out the arrow, which is made with a certain type of wood that purposefully fractures in the elephant. So it goes in straight, but it cracks like a splinter, so you can't take it out. And then we did the reversal process to wake the elephant up. And I think we all assumed that this elephant would wake up and be a little drowsy and say thank you to the humans and walk off in another direction. And it, like, snapped up on four legs and chased us down and, you know, almost killed my cameraman. My herpetologist jumped in front of this elephant and, and asked it to stop, and it did stop. But it's a wild animal. It could have killed all of us if it felt like it.
Crazy.
Yeah.
The situation in the with the elephants is so sad. I always wondered, especially since you're out there, if you were in a situation where you saw someone poaching an elephant or hurting an elephant, what would you do?
Well, you have to be careful, obviously, because a lot of times those people are armed, you know, and they will mess with you if you mess with them. I mean, these are people who are trying to earn a living, and you're messing around with their living, you know. So hopefully you'd be with an official. If we were with the veterinarian who had armed guards with him, he obviously would have stopped them in their tracks. And they kill people there. You know, I mean, this guy said it is a war. It's a nightly war. And if we see guys with guns that are going out trying to kill elephants, we will shoot those people dead, you know. So it's a war. So you have to be careful about how you deal with it. But education's a big thing with those animal, with those people, just to kind of show them what happened in places like Rwanda. I mean, Rwanda's a great success story for the gorilla. This was an animal that they would kill, chop off the hands, use the hands as ashtrays, chop off the heads, use the...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so they would kill the gorilla, use the hands as ashtrays, and then use the heads, like the skulls, as, you know, like rich people would have them in their house. And what happened was there was a massive education change in the country of Rwanda where they said, look, you can kill an elephant and make $5,000 off that elephant, or on a yearly basis, we can invite Western tourists into your country. And the country of Rwanda can earn hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars from the tourist money for people to come in and see gorillas in the wild. So now the people of Rwanda protect their animals. They protect their gorillas. And we need to try and have that shift in some of these other countries. I mean, we were in Kenya doing the elephant show. It was actually a show where I was looking for the giant spitting cobra. And in that year, a rhino went extinct. The second largest land mammal in the world went extinct in the world, like not just in Kenya, but on our planet in that year, in 2014, is the eastern white rhino went extinct. So, I mean, apart from the elephant, which is the largest land mammal, the second largest is the rhinoceros, and it went extinct. What does that say about us as a species? We knew it was happening. We could see it occurring.
And we couldn't stop it.
It's a massive animal, and we couldn't stop it, you know. So hopefully that won't happen with the elephant. I don't think it will happen with the elephant because it's such a sign of conservation, the elephant. You know, it's almost like a living symbol of conservation. Yeah. So if that animal dies, we're done for.
There's no saving us.
No.
At that point, I think with elephants, when you know them, you see when you're educated, which is why it's so great you're doing a show like this. I think, especially with the amount of fans that you have, it's so great that you're putting yourself out there and you're doing this because education is so important. So when you know that an elephant is so emotional and has, you know, human level emotions and that they mourn their dead for a month or so. I mean, when you know all of these things and you understand them, then you know why we have to protect them and why we have to save them. And
there's so many things we don't know about elephants that, you know, are profound. And like you said, I mean, the way that they obviously are emotionally connected to each other is on a human level, you know. They remember people, they remember other animals, they remember certain areas where a certain event may have occurred. They're a very powerful animal. Not only that, but they bind together lots of areas of Africa, you know, the Serengeti and places like Tsavo and that place that you went. If elephants disappear from those places, it collapses the population of all the other animals. The lions are affected and the wildebeest are affected and the warthogs are affected. It's like a keystone species, so we have to protect them, you know.
So how many safaris have you gone on at this point?
You mean like paid?
Like a real safari. I mean, you're going, you know, hardcore doing it your own way, but have you gone on any really good ones that you suggest to people?
Yeah, I've been on two at this point. The rest are all work-based stuff. I went to Kenya a few years ago and did a safari, which was incredible. Saw an animal called an aardwolf, which is very, very bizarre. Nocturnal mammal. It's like a Wolverine-type-looking creature. Mm-hmm. It's very bizarre. That was my favorite thing that I saw. You know, saw hyenas and zebras and stuff. Went to Rwanda and did the hike to see the lowland gorillas, which was pretty extraordinary.
Is that the one when they come, you know, right up to you?
Yeah, they'll come right up to you. And
I've seen video of that. That's scary.
They're used to you. Well, they're used to humans. They might not be used to you, but they're used to humans coming and seeing you. So they just hang out. They spend a lot of the time sleeping and eating. But the kids and the teenagers, like kid and teenager humans, are a little bit more inquisitive, and they'll come over and they'll push up next to you. And the guy just said, look, the gorilla can come to you, but you can't come to the gorilla. So you stand still. If the gorilla comes towards you, just stand still. So there was a couple of times where the teenagers had, you know, come up to me and just like bump my shoulder, and I'd be like, hey, what's up? And then it would just woke up.
I can't.
But the silverback, I mean, the silverback was lying on his back for like half an hour, and it was just this gargantuan beast. And my guide said to me, he's going to get up. The silverback's going to get up. I said, how can you tell? And he said, oh, he's making this noise, this noise, which is like, hey, just letting everyone know I'm going to start moving because it's a big animal. And this silverback gets up and it's like, you know, 10, 11 feet tall and just goes to walk off into the jungle. And as he walks off into the jungle to get away from the humans, he walks past his girlfriend and just annihilates his girlfriend. Just
like beats her up?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, no way.
Like three or four punches. Just walks past him. She's lying there just like chilling with her baby. And he goes, bang, 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 on her. And she's like, aah! And then he just walks off into the forest. And I'm like, why did he do that? And the human, our guide is like, he's probably doing it for us. He's probably saying, like,
this is my bitch.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I'm like, I own all of you. You know, I can do this to this lady, but I could do it to all of you. And he just walked off. But I mean, in terms of like a specimen, a physical specimen, never seen anything like
that. Is that the craziest thing you think you've ever seen?
Animal-wise, I mean, I've seen some pretty epic insect battles that blew my mind. You know, ants and wasps going at each other over the course of a day in Brazil and Ecuador and Argentina. I'll tell you what I saw in Argentina that was absolutely fascinating for me. I was on a night hike with a guy in the jungle in the Amazon, the little part of the Amazon that Argentina has. And we're walking, we're heading back to camp, pitch black. We've all got headlamps on, but you can barely see anything. And my guide says, do you smell that smell? And I was like, yeah, I smell that smell. It's like a musky, lemony smell. He said, do you know what that is? I said, no. He said, it's Apelions. I said, what's Apelions? He said, oh, it's like a type of spider, like a daddy longlegs. Like we call them harvestmen in England. In the States, you call them daddy longlegs.
Yeah.
And he said, turn your light on, look at the floor. So I turn my light on, look at the floor. The entire jungle floor is full of these Apelions just running away. And I'm like, what's going on? And he says, there's army ants coming our way. So the army ants are running towards the Apelions, the daddy longlegs. The daddy longlegs are running, but they're sending a message through the jungle floor saying, army ants are coming. So you guys all need to bounce at the same time as we are. So as we're walking, you can see that other animals are picking up on these messages. So all the like land-dwelling animals are smelling this scent, picking up on this scent that the spiders are leaving behind, and they're all running. And then 10 minutes later, we walk into this huge swath of army ants, but all the other forest animals have gone by that point. And it blew my mind, because I was like, wow, it's another species of animal telling all the other animals in the jungle, hey, something dangerous happening, you guys need to run away.
That's funny.
That's probably one of the more mind-blowing things I've seen.
I have a photo of a lion. Like, you know, this lion was, you know, on the side of the road, and there were giraffe and ostrich and all kinds of animals. And once the lion got up, they all started to run. And I have this picture where they're all staggered in the foreground and the background and the middle, and they're all running this way. I couldn't get the lion in the frame, but they're all running away. So the ants were the lion in this equation.
Yeah, yeah.
That's crazy.
And those cues are very, very clear in the natural world, in nature. You know, when the big boss comes along, you move. And if you don't move, there's a pretty good chance that you'll die, you know. That's why, I mean, I'm really not that much of a fan of humans. They're not my favorite animal. There's probably my least favorite animal on the planet, and there's so many other animals that I like more. And one of the major reasons why I like animals much more than humans is the vast majority of animals, save maybe a couple, don't lie. They don't have the ability to lie. They don't have the sophistication to lie. So they will tell you, I'm angry. This is how I'm going to show you my anger. I'm happy. This is how I'm going to show you my happiness. But a human being, you can sit with a human being at a bar or a dinner table and say, are you okay? And they'll say, yeah, I'm fine. And you know they're not fine. You know they're lying to you. I don't like that feeling when someone's lying to me. But animals don't do that, you know?
I think that you just hit on the head why I love animals so much, too. And I think that's why a lot of people love animals, is exactly that reason. I never kind of put it into words. I always just said I had a great connection with them. And I, you know, I felt like they understood me and I understood them. But it is the honesty. And I feel like, especially in the business that we are in, it is not an easy one to navigate when you are your truth at all times. And I feel like they almost make you have to adopt their system just to survive. I don't know if you've seen that and experienced that.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
You know?
You have to get, if I'm hanging out with a snake, I have to get a little snakey. If I'm hanging out with a spider, I have to get a little spidery. I have to get into that mindset. But what's great about those interactions is they don't lie. They'll tell you, you know, they'll say, I'm angry. If you take a step back, I'll be less angry. So you take a step back and then they'll show you, okay, I'm less angry. You know, I mean, I like that. The interesting thing about hanging out with people that are lying to you in terms of humans, if I'm hanging out with a human and they're not being honest with me, or they're lying, or they're keeping a secret, it makes me feel like a liar. It makes me feel like I have a secret. It makes me feel like I'm being dishonest, because I'm like a sponge. I'm an actor. So I pick up on this feeling. If it feels awkward, it makes me feel awkward. But with animals, they tend not to make me feel awkward because they're honest. You know, I can deal with honesty. I'd much rather someone says, you know what, you kind of got on my nerves, then, it's all right, it's not a big deal. And then they go home and bitch about you.
Yeah.
Or they blow you up on Twitter.
It's true. Yeah, because when you are sensitive, you know. And I think to be close with animals, you have a whole other level of sensitivity. And then as an actor for you, I always say as a reporter, I can sniff anybody out. I see you. I know exactly what I'm dealing with instantly because I've interviewed so many people. So I think that's really interesting. Is there anything you won't do or won't attempt on this show?
Are we talking about animals?
Insects, animals.
There's no animal I'm scared of. There's no animal that I don't want to have an experience with. I mean, if you were to think about the archetypal animals that scare people and the archetypal animals that fill me with certainly a level of intimidation, great white shark.
Hippos.
We did hippopotamus in Zambia. Which will be this year. Yeah. Yeah, we got super close to hippopotamus. You know that their milk is pink?
No.
Yeah, it's interesting.
That's crazy. And, we had one walk by our truck. I mean, we could have reached out and touched it. It was so close.
And huge, right?
It just came out of nowhere. We didn't even know.
Yeah.
And so everyone had to just stay calm because obviously they could crush you in the car. It doesn't matter.
They kill more humans than any other animal on the African continent, apart from mosquitoes, I think, which obviously, you know, slay people with malaria. But wait, what was I saying?
You know,
your archetypal fear-based animals.
Crocs, the whole thing.
Great white shark, lion, tiger, gorilla. I mean, I respect them. If I was in the open ocean and I saw a massive great white shark, it would make me scared. But I still would like to have an experience where I'm safe and with that animal, you know, free diving with that animal. So we're working on a shark show at the moment for season 3 that we hope to do. You know, we got pretty close to that elephant. That's probably the, outside of the polar bear, it's probably the scariest land animal. You know, I want to do polar bears too. Mm-hmm. So
can I do that one?
Yeah, you want to do polar bears? All right,
yes. Cool.
You look so good in white. No, we can do pretty much anything. I mean, there's certain things that I won't do on the show in terms of
eating.
Yeah. I won't eat a lot of animals, and also I don't want to make fun of the animals. Or there's a word that I really like, which is hard to say. Anthropomorphize.
Anthropomorphize. Right. Yeah, it's a Greek.
Oh, is it Greek?
Yeah.
Nice. Anthropomorphize, which is to turn to give an animal human characteristics.
Yeah. Anthropo is Greek. Nice. So anthropo means person.
Nice.
Yeah.
So I never do that. I never do this thing of holding onto a snake and giving it a voice, you know, oh, leave me alone. I don't like you, or I'm going to bite you. I don't do that. These animals deserve our respect. They're wild. They're noble. They're regal. They deserve to be respected. They're not teddy bears, you know, so I won't do that. But in terms of any animal, fair game.
Wow.
But I'll keep you in mind for polar bears.
I can't believe you're going into the water, too.
Yeah, we went into the water this season. I did Barrier Reef. We swam with sharks. We went looking for arguably the world's most venomous animal on the planet, the box jellyfish. Swam with turtles, octopus, cuttlefish. Found a 14-foot amethystine python in the back of someone's house, which is Australia's biggest snake. And it was wrapped up underneath the table, and I saw it. I was with a snake expert who got a call. He was like, come with me, we'll get the snake. I saw it, and I said, can I pull it out? And he was like, yeah, it looks pretty big. Snake, just be careful with that one. I was like, all right, I'll be careful. And as I started to unravel this thing, it just kept going and going and going. And the good thing about this snake was that it wasn't in any way aggressive, because it could have easily got hold of me. But it didn't. Just tried to get away. So in the scene, I'm just saying, look, here's a wild animal, probably never had this experience with a human before, and all it's interested in doing is getting up that hill and getting away from me. Beautiful snake.
Wow. Okay, so apart from your BBC show, Wild Things, you've got the Swedish show.
Right.
Or is it a movie or was it a show?
Swedish TV show, cop show. It's called The 100 Code. I play a New York cop. So for the past month or so, I've been walking around my house with a New York accent, which, to be totally honest, has been making me go a little insane.
Okay.
But it's okay. I'm all right with that. I can tap into the crazy okay. And he's a New York cop from Hell's Kitchen who is following a very specific serial killer and a case similar to the cases that he's been investigating in New York crops up in Stockholm, Sweden. So he goes to Stockholm with a gun and a badge and thinks that he can run around the streets of Stockholm and catch this guy. And he has a whole bunch of bureaucratic hoops that he has to jump through in Sweden with these Swedish cops. So it's me and a guy called Michael Nyquist, who was in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and is a great actor. And it just, you know, the script is really fantastic, and I wanted to play the kind of hero for a change, and he's from New York, which I'm not from, so that was interesting. And I don't know, Sweden's kind of sexy, right? I
mean, it's
a sexy part of the world. It's supposed to be very expensive, and there's not a huge amount of animals there for me. You know, I spend a lot of my weekends going off in search of animals, but you can snowboard there and you can hang out, I'm sure. It's supposed to be a lot of lovely people you can meet there.
So you get a break from the animals a little bit.
Get a break from the animals a little bit, so that'll go until end of October, start of November. And then I think I'll spend the rest of this year, you know, working out where we're going to go for Wild Things 3. Mm-hmm. And then I do Wild Things 3, like, January, February of 2015.
Now, are there... You're shooting Wild Things how many months a year? You said eight?
Yeah, it's about eight.
That's a long time.
Yeah. I mean, we do a significant amount of research before we go out there. Then we're out there for about 7-8 days. Then I come back, I have about 5 days off, go see my doctor, make sure I'm okay, clean up all my cuts and scars and stuff, and then we go out again.
Now, 8 months a year, are you worried about the fact that, you know, now you're kind of, you're fitting your acting career into this life now, whereas before... Your life was your acting life. Is it just that it's a nice break after all these, you know, really intense roles that you've taken on that were so, you know, consuming?
Yeah, it. I mean, I tend not to overthink it too much because, you know, I always call these things like champagne problems, you know, like it's a great phrase, which is your wallet's too small for your 50s and your diamond shoes are too tight. You know, I happen to be working a lot. That's fine. I'll deal with that, you know. I'm also working on things that I'm really passionate about. I'm really interested to see how I feel about acting now, because it's been about 18 months since I actually acted on camera with other actors.
No way.
Yeah, because I've been doing Wild Things, and before that I was, you know, trying to get Wild Things up and, you know, running.
Wow.
So it took me a long time. So I'm interested to see if I get the same verve out of acting that I've always had, because I am super passionate about animals. That's one of the things that I'm the most passionate about in my life. But the thing that I am the most passionate about is acting. Mm-hmm. So I want to see if that comes back. Because at the moment, to be perfectly honest, the thing I'm the most passionate about is making the show and traveling around the world and doing the show. So I'll see if I get the acting bug again.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like you're on such an adventure that you're just going to keep figuring yourself out through, right? Which is cool. That's life. I always say, if you're not growing, you're dying. So.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm so lucky, and I'm doing what I love, and I happen to be getting paid for it at the same time. You know, I think there'll come a time in my life where maybe I'll want things to be a little bit more easy for me to predict in terms of my life, because my mm-hmm. life tends to live out of a suitcase and, you know, I fly to different places and stuff. Maybe at some point my lifestyle will be different and I'll look for something else. But at the moment, while I'm, you know, young-ish and, you know, doing my thing, I'll just keep doing it, you know?
I know. Do you think about, like, getting married, having a family, all that stuff? Is that...
Yeah, I do. My brother's going to have a kid in July, so it's the first time I'm ever going to be an uncle, which is great. I'm a kind of surrogate uncle to a lot of cousins and second cousins and stuff, so I know what that's like. But for it to be much closer to me, for my mm-hmm. brother to be having a child, is, you know, a great feeling and something that I'm very excited about. It does make me think about, you know, having children and finding a lady that would do that. But to be honest, like, I have this conversation all the time, like, I don't know who's gonna put up with that. I don't know who's gonna say, that's fine, baby, you go and do your passion and I'll be with the kids, and when you get back I'll see you for 4 days and then you can go to Brazil and risk your life doing this, and then you can, like, pick up the entire family and take us to Australia. Like, I don't know what amazing woman's gonna sign on for that, but one day.
I think she exists.
Well, she probably exists. I don't know where she is.
You gotta find her out in the Serengeti, or, like, you're gonna probably find her in your travels.
Yeah, maybe.
To be honest.
Maybe. She might have to have the same passions that I have, but I don't know how long that lasts, honestly. You know, I've hung out with people for a long enough amount of time, and we will eventually have that conversation where, you know, people like, you know, your career is so overwhelmingly influential mm-hmm. on the choices that you make. Like, I'm left with the pieces that are left behind, you know, and I really don't have an answer for that. I'm like, yeah, that's true. I really love what I do. Sorry, I love you too. But, like, I really want to go and do this. Like, if I had a girlfriend right now and I was going to Sweden, the option would be, hey, babe, do you want to come to Sweden with me? Because I'm going to Sweden.
Yeah.
That's not really an option at all, you know. So it's going to take a really amazing woman or a bunch of really average ones.
Yeah, it's hard. It is hard. And I always say that's why it's tough to have two really career-oriented people, especially in this business, together, because in my relationship, Kevin and I have been together for 16 years.
It's impressive.
And the reason it works is because he's behind me in my career. So he's coming with me into my world. So I'm not having to negotiate those terms necessarily. He's like, okay, yours is the dominant one. We're going to put everything we have behind yours. Mm. So there's your Kevin out there.
Yes, maybe there is a Kevin. Or maybe it's Kevin. I may break you guys up. You never know. No. Kevin and I might go for a coffee after this. You never
Kevin
know.
Kevin wouldn't come on not one of these trips.
Oh, it's a nice thing.
Oh my God, we are completely opposite in this. And
that's a great thing too, in terms of attraction. If you have, you know, opposites attract, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. You know, I'm lucky enough to be friends with J.J. Abrams. You know, he directed and wrote the Lost pilot and was an exec producer on that. And he's married to an amazing woman, and they have a fantastic marriage. She's, you know, she has all this philanthropic work that she does, and they have a great family, and they do it. And, I mean, I've talked to J.J. and Katie about that. I'm like, how do you guys make it work? Like, it's not easy to make it work. And they're like, well, we made it work. You just... Yeah. You'll find someone and it'll be effortless. That's what I've found in terms of, like, any kind of, you know, intimate relationship that I've had in my life. The ones that work, generally, certainly for the first 9 months or so, are just effortless. Mm-hmm. You're not having to trudge through a whole bunch of history or pain or baggage. It's just like champagne and strawberries in the Hollywood Bowl for a few months. And then you can get into, like, the business of, you know, what's real. But at first, I feel like it should just be
fun.
Easy. Yeah, fun and easy.
Yeah. Speaking of JJ, actually, do you guys have anything you talk about work-wise in reteaming again?
I mean, I'm constantly talking to JJ about trying to do stuff with him. Obviously, you know, he's someone who... Oh, I dropped something. He's someone who I admire, and I you know, love the choices that he makes and the projects that he picks. So I'm hopeful that at some point we'll do something. He's also kind of, you know, quite a mentor in my life, so I'll reach out to him via email or on the phone, and I'll be like, hey, this is happening, what do you think? Like, what would you do? What would you advise? And, you know, if JJ's not busy or if he has a good piece of advice, he'll pass it along. So he's been kind of a guiding kind of spirit as I've moved into different areas mm-hmm. of my career. But I mean, in terms of doing something with him again, he would just have to call me, you know. That's it. Like, I wouldn't go, oh, what's the part or what's the script? You would just say, do you want to do this thing? And I say, yeah. I mean, that's
what's jump. That's
what's earned after a certain amount of, connection with someone or a friendship. It would be the same thing with Peter Jackson. He wouldn't have to go through any channels of like, okay, we'll negotiate a deal and we'll send you the script. He would just say, do you want to come to New Zealand and do this thing? And I'd say, yeah, you know, that's how it works.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
What did JJ and Peter respectively say about your show?
Peter's really, really scared of spiders. If you watch his work, you can see that. In The Hobbit, there's some very scary spiders. Mm-hmm. In Lord of the Rings, Shelob is a very scary spider based on a black widow, which is a highly venomous spider. He does not like spiders at all. So he invited me to the London premiere of The Hobbit, and we went back to his house, and I showed him the episode where I go to Laos to look for the world's largest spider, which was way bigger than my hand. And Pete, he's got his own little cinema in his house, and Pete was sat in his cinema like this.
Just showing him a video.
Yeah, just showing him the show. He's like, what are you doing? Put it down, what are you doing? So he's definitely kind of nervy and, you know, thinks that I'm a little bit crazy. And then I think JJ really likes it because I think his kids watch it, you know. Mm-hmm. I've asked JJ a bunch, have you seen my show? JJ's like, well, I'm a little busy right now, but my kids have seen it and they really like it. So it's kind of, you know, halfway there.
That's so great. Yeah. I love it. Well, I'm a big fan. I'm excited to watch Tuesday nights, 10 o'clock on the BBC, Wild Things with Dominic Monaghan. Before I wrap this up, I have to ask you, I thought it was really, really amazing and very just sweet. I always think it's really wonderful when people remember our legends. And Mickey Rooney passed just this past weekend, and you tweeted about that. Mm. And I thought it was really sweet because it's so easy to forget the elders. And I've always been someone who has just loved our elderly community, whether they're famous or not. And so I thought it was really sweet that you tweeted out about him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the unfortunate thing about our societies, certainly our Western societies, is we kind of forget and shun our elderly. We kind of push them into a cupboard and go, can you go die quietly? Because I don't want to deal with that, because I'm going to have to die quietly years later. And that's something I don't want to deal with at the moment. So I think it's a shame that we treat people like that. And I think the thing that I'd said about Mickey Rooney, which was totally true, was he was one of the real first Western trailblazers in terms of child actors. Mm-hmm. And the pressure of being that child actor, one of the first, him and Shirley Temple, who also died recently too, you know, they set the stage for child actors. They also set the stage that you can have people at that age working in a very adult business. And it must have been so isolating and difficult for those characters. It's like, I always feel like, you know, the Beatles always talk about it with Elvis. The Beatles were like, it was very, very difficult for us to understand what was happening, but there was four of us experiencing it, so we were okay. Elvis was on his own, and he's like looking around going, it's just me. And that's the same thing with Shirley Temple and Mickey Rooney. They were kind of going, there's no one really in my peer group that's having the same amount of experiences that I'm having. And he did some great performances, and he always seemed to be a very positive, happy kind of guy. And he deserved it. I mean, you know, he seemed to be an amazing guy.
Oh, that's so great. And just, again, just how amazing of you to kind of know that and to, you know, be able to dive into their kind of lives and know that. And, you know, because everyone can say he was amazing as an actor and he was amazingly positive, but to know, you know, to be kind of aware enough to realize that they had to pave this very difficult path alone is really cool. And I had a really nice moment with him because I was friends with him through a mutual friend. I've had a lot of experiences with some of our old Hollywood legends, and he was one of them. And he came to my house for Thanksgiving last year.
Nice.
With his family. And we were sitting at the dinner table. I think I had like 30 people that I cooked for that day.
Impressive.
Love cooking Thanksgiving dinner. And I was at the long table on this side, and he was at the round table over here, and he started singing. Right after we said grace, he started singing Imaginary Cowboy.
That's right.
The last words were, until the day I die. You're my imaginary cowboy until the day I die. And I'm sitting there filming it on my iPhone. This is unbelievable. I have a legend in my house. And he's giving us a performance.
Yeah.
Ended up being his last performance.
Wow.
Which was amazing. He was so cool. I set him up in the living room later. We were all playing Pictionary, and he wanted to watch the football game. So I was like, okay, I set up the football game for him. He was watching. He's like, we need to work together. And I was like, I would love that, Mickey. let's figure it out.
Yeah, like, think about the stories he must have had. Like, he met everyone. He did everything. You know? And Shirley Temple, too. Did you meet Shirley Temple?
I did not meet Shirley Temple.
That's an impressive woman. Yeah. That's someone who obviously had, you know, all these great opportunities thrown at her throughout her life. And she chose whatever path she wanted to do and became, you know, someone who worked with animals and a great humanitarian. And she seemed to live a really fantastic life, you know, so. You can do it, you know. You can be that big and be that normal, it seems.
Absolutely. Mm. Well, you're a shining example of that.
Oh, well, thank you.
Excuse me. So, all right. I think that's, you know, I feel like there's so many more things that I would love to ask you, but we'll have to do this again.
Yeah, we'll do it the second time, and then I can interview you and you do the show, so we have time.
Perfect. Yeah. I love that. Thank you so much. Everyone has a story, and this is just part of Dominic Monaghan's. To see more about my time with him today, visit conversationswithmaria.com, and you can find and watch the new season of Wild Things Tuesdays at 10 o'clock, 9 central on the BBC America. Thank you so much.
Lovely talking to you.
Sweet.
Nice.
That was so fun.
From executive producers Harvey Weinstein, Lisa Gregorish, Kevin Undergaro, Maria Menounos, and the entire Conversation staff, we would like to thank you for listening to Conversations with Maria Menounos. To post comments or questions, be sure to visit conversationswithmaria.com or tweet at Maria Menounos, hashtag Conversations with Maria. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Weinstein Company, Telepictures, and Underman Omega Girl Productions.